Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I am Jonathan McCrae. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about plant forensics or forensic botanists who use information and clues from plants to solve crimes. It's a really interesting one. And at the end of the pod, myself and Aidan have some interesting reflections on it, so stay with us for that. In the meantime, if you want to email us, science@newstalk.com, we get to all of those comments later on. And we kick off, as always, looking back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Laura Hayes and Tara Shine. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Tara, has to do with the pandemic, which was so difficult for all of us, so incredibly painful for many, so serious, a global condition that surely it can never happen again.
One would hope. Unfortunately, this story is about the fact that we're actually unprepared for the next pandemic because we haven't got it together at a global level to agree on how we're going to collaborate in the next pandemic. So there will be another pandemic. Question is, can we learn and do better than the last time? And the last time, although it was awful for all of us, looked at globally, it was most awful for people in poorer countries. And so it really increased inequities and inequalities in the world. And so what is trying to be agreed now is a system to more equitably share information, genetic information, but also the benefits like the vaccines that will be needed in the next pandemic. And basically, the world is a bit stuck on agreeing all of that.
Any nations stand out in particular here?
It's a real north-south divide. Reading about this really reminded me of the climate negotiations. So the developed countries on one side are quite keen to hang on, if you like, to their preferential access to the vaccines, which ultimately are developed in the north, which is where all the labs are. But in order to create those, they have to get access to the pathogens and the genetic material, which comes from all over the world, including the global south. And so what they're trying to do is create a system that is going to be fairer in the way that we provide access to these pathogens and develop and share access to the solutions. And although an initial kind of accord was agreed back in May 2025, it was only agreed because they fudged this issue of pathogen access and benefit sharing. They stuck it into an annex and said they'd come back to it later. Later is now. They haven't been able to agree it. And then on the 1st of May, they've actually had to push it into their next session in Geneva under the WHO. So it continues on into the month of July with the two amazing ladies leading this process, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, former president of Liberia, and Helen Clark, former president of New Zealand, are the two at the helm of this, trying to steer the countries of the world to an agreement.
Now, in today's socio-political environment, can any country, when put up against it, be expected to behave as it should in a treaty like this in the face of something like the pandemic we saw before? Because we saw countries behave in ways they absolutely shouldn't, you know, and I'm just wondering what the point of a treaty like this is when it comes to it's you or us, mate. Are countries really going to follow a treaty like this, or are they going to act in self-interest, not looking at any country in particular?
So I guess that's a bigger question about, you know, the future and the present, if you like, of multilateralism. So multilateralism exists, and that's part of like the world order of things, which, you know, leaders like Trump are very willing to break that world order and break those common rules. But the problem is that in something like a global pandemic, same as with climate change, things like this, no one country can make themselves safe completely in a globalized world. So even the countries that shut themselves down completely during the COVID-19 pandemic, they still needed other countries for goods and services. They still needed other countries because they perhaps created the vaccine. So no country is an island in this sense, that no country can actually exist on it. So they can try for a while and try and look after themselves. But as every country needs another country for something, I imagine it would break down over time. That's why we have the multilateral systems. But is the multilateral system under threat at the moment because of the actions of bad actors? Yes, but I think, you know, good reason to double down on these shared rules.
Well, I mean, you know, when you think about the developing countries, as they're sometimes called, forming a coalition where you basically shut off raw materials to the north if they don't share, you know, science, innovation, and access to vaccines might end up being quite a powerful move. So it'd be really interesting to see how in the future developing countries might navigate, you know, that being shut off as they were during the first pandemic.
Exactly. And imagine if those developing countries were at the heart of the next pandemic and they refused to share the genetic material or information around how that virus was affecting their people. Mm. Then it would slow down the process of understanding that virus, of developed countries being able to be prepared and ready for it, of being able to slow down like global travel systems. So unless everybody cooperates in this, it can't work. We can't all be safe. So yeah. Again, this is another one of those things where it's in everybody's best interest, actually, to get this global system up the line.
Unfortunately, like so many problems in our world, it's as simple as the nose in your face. If everybody collaborates, we solve this problem. But that's not how the world works, unfortunately. Interesting to see what happens in the next pandemic. Our second story, Laura, has to do with magic mushrooms.
Magic mushrooms, it does indeed. And this is something that we have talked about before, is the effects of, you know, psychedelic drugs on your mental state. And this is an interesting study because this moves psychological, like psychedelic research, beyond the question of, you know, when you take them, do people hallucinate? But trying to look at the measurable impacts on the brain. We've talked before about how magic mushrooms and DMT have a very positive effect with people with depression and long-term depression. But this really looks
at... Under controlled use.
Exactly. Nobody go out and...
Consult your doctor.
Yes, absolutely. But there's a huge amount of research going on to see how these type of psychedelic drugs impact your brain. So this study actually looked at psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. But they looked at 28 healthy volunteers who had never taken, you know, psychedelics before. And this is maybe in comparison to a lot of studies who have, you know, tried these with people who have depression. But looking at, you know, healthy active volunteers, average age around 41, and tried to give them kind of a high dose of psilocybin. So 25 milligrams, not just your microdosing, you're having a full psychedelic effect.
Right.
And what they did is they measured their brain activity and their well-being both during, before their trip, during their trip, and then a month after their trip. And what they found was, you know, by looking at, you know, MRIs and EEGs of their brain, they found it's kind of increased brain entropy during their trip. So if you think of your brain in some way becoming less rigid, you know, less repetitive, less predictable in some senses.
Crusty old brain.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of opening up these new pathways. And they found this during, you know, 2 hours into their maybe 4 hour trip, it was the most entropic brain entropy that they had. So they were able to measure this. And then after that, they found, you know, there was this, still this increase in brain entropy. But those that had kind of the highest brain entropy during this time actually found, you know, a month later had a, you know, a better well-being, was feeling good, having kind of new life insights.
Yeah, but like, could they tie their shoelaces? I mean, and that's obviously an extreme example. Yeah, I mean is, you know, is permanent change of our brain where, you know, you're more open to change, is that always a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very early study in trying to measure that, right? What are these long-term impacts? And they actually found that there are possible anatomical changes to your brain. Now, it's not that you're completely rewired and that's not what the study is saying at all,
right.
But there are kind of small, subtle changes in the white matter pathways of your brain. So thinking of a kind of, you know, shaking things up a little bit to kind of help with these pathways that might be in a negative way repetitive. So again, it's kind of that.
But they don't know what the consequences of these changes. By the way, no judgment here. You do you. Mm-hmm. But my question is the changes that they're talking about, because we've heard about positive mental changes and so on. But these permanent changes that happen as a result of taking hallucinogens. Do we have any idea whether or not they may have negative consequences in the future?
Well, yeah, I guess this is what we're trying to find. And they found for this study with healthy participants in a controlled environment, no.
Thank you, Laura. Our third story, Tara, has to do with knee surgery. And it's quite timely because I just banged my knee in football yesterday.
Yeah, so this study from the University of Helsinki is going on about 20 years. And they have found that the most common type of knee surgery is ineffective. It doesn't work, doesn't do anything. And in fact, it could possibly make things worse.
Wow.
And this is the most common orthopedic procedure globally. I think this is amazing.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, so this is like, this is an amazing Finnish study. It's a great example of collaboration, unlike the previous story I was talking about. But where they did clinical trials back between 2007 and 2012, and they had 126 participants take part, and they all had mechanical knee problems. So that was like knee catching.
Yeah.
Or knee locking, right?
Yeah.
And they were aged between 35 and 65, and they were randomly assigned to groups. And some of them got the actual surgery. The surgery is called arthroscopic partial meniscectomy. And so half of them got the surgery, and the half had a sham surgery or a placebo, basically. So they didn't actually get the surgery, but they didn't know. And they then reviewed the patients to look at what the impact had been 2, 6, and 12 months later. And they found no statistical difference between the placebo and the actual surgery.
Wow.
Just none. And this caused consternation back in 2018 when they did the 5-year follow-up and they published their results, and the whole orthopedic community was thrown into disarray, and they were accused of having, like, you know, malpractice in the way they had designed their trial, or someone even said that they had, you know, recruited people that weren't of full mental capacity to take part in the
trial. They were that sure that I mean, this is the thing: when you're bought into doing something, you've seen the results in people, and you're so sure of something, you know, you have this confirmation bias that it's hard then when someone says what you've been doing for 15 years and charging people before, you know, and that's your specialty. It's a complete waste of time. It's very difficult, I'd imagine, to accept that.
And it's still, you know, it's still going on. People are still getting this procedure all the time. And this is what they say, that what this shows is that there are embedded practices in the orthopedic professional community that are based on strong biological rationale rather than scientific rigor. So it makes sense that if you've got a locked knee or a catching knee, that there is some physical thing in the way. They call it a mechanical blockage, a mechanical problem. And so they want then to go in and take that bit of torn meniscus out so that your knee works properly again. And because that all seems so completely logical, on and on we keep going and doing it, even though what this study shows and all the follow-ups to it and all the reviews of it is that there is no difference between having the surgery and not having the surgery.
How many patients in this?
126.
It's not insignificant.
It's not insignificant.
That's not a tiny study given, you know, we're talking about knee surgery.
It seems very rigorous in how they conducted it. They say that one of the key problems is aging. Okay, but the patients were between 35 and 65. But often it's just age, but it does appear in athletes like yourself, obviously, Jonathan, as well. That could be the issue. But not only does it not make it better, it can also make you more likely to have problems like osteoarthritis. So having the surgery makes you more likely.
Wow.
And
that doesn't happen very often in any sort of medical practice. You completely say, actually, we shouldn't be doing this, particularly in 2026. Our final story, Laura, has to do with planets.
Yeah, absolutely. So imagine standing on a planet with two suns in the sky, right? So like Tatooine and Star Wars, if you're a Star Wars fan, there's actually a study that was released this week on May the 4th, Star Wars Day, very apt, which showed evidence actually of 27 planets were circumbinary planets orbiting eclipsing binary stars. So this is two stars and a planet orbiting it. Now, what's unique here is that they detected these planets in a very different way. They detected them with tiny gravitational fingerprints that they leave on these stars. Right, we're living in a world now where we have thousands of exoplanets. In the mid-90s, we had our 9 planets in our solar system. And typically how we look at these exoplanets is we look at a star and we see these planets transiting that star and we see a dip of light. But that's very hard when you have two stars and you really have to get the angles correct.
Planets can only belong to one star.
Well, this is what we're saying. That's not true. You can have an eclipsing binary star, so these two star systems, and then a planet orbiting that.
A planet orbiting both of them?
Yes.
That is badass.
Yeah, yeah. It's super cool. And, you know, very recently kind of discovered. So this is what this paper did. They found 27 new candidate planets that may be orbiting these stars. And, you know, these binary star systems are, you know, half of the stars that we see are these eclipsing binary stars.
So, it's still one like ellipse, presumably. Yeah. It's not like a figure of eight or anything. Like,
no, yeah, yeah.
That would be really cool.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, some of them could have these crazy orbits that we don't necessarily fully know yet, right? We can't see them. So we have to try to identify these type of different kind of methods to seeing them. But if you think you're kind of all orbiting some center of mass in the middle of those two stars, you can also have planets that are orbiting one star and then the other star is there and all these different orientations. But again, that makes it really hard to see because we can't just see these exoplanets. They're so, so faint. So we have to do kind of really smart techniques like this gravitational thing of seeing how this gravitational pull of these planets have an impact on the star And then we could look at the stars and see are there tiny wobbles in those stars. And then we can infer, oh, maybe there's planets orbiting. And that's what this study did using NASA's TESS satellite, which looks at all these stars and tried to see the orbits of these stars moving in front of each other and compared that to what it predictedly should be. And then anything off that, basically like a clock drifting, is we can say that there are these planets. So 27 potential new planets have been discovered. So the idea is now we'll go follow up these with different satellites that will look at different kind of properties to see if we can really see that are these really new circumbinary planets.
That's really, really cool. I didn't know that was possible. Dr. Laura Hayes and Dr. Tara Shine, thank you so much. Okay, on the way, fighting crime with plants.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew!
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. As an investigator, what would you expect to find at a murder scene? A body, obviously. A weapon, hopefully. Some extraneous evidence would be nice too. Maybe a dropped phone or a wallet. If you're thinking about justice, about a conviction, these might be the sort of things you'd be looking for. But if the crime happened outside, then it's likely that over 90% of what's at the scene will be plants. And they could just be the key to the whole case. Christopher Hardy is a forensic botanist and biology professor at Millersville University. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Chris. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
This is new. I've never heard of forensic botany. Please explain.
Well, that's because even though you're correct in citing that plants occupy or comprise about 90% of the biomass in nature, many people are blind to that potential source of evidence. And so it's underutilized. Typically, forensic investigators are not trained to necessarily see the utility of the plant matter. But sometimes it's so obvious that they do see and recognize its potential, and that's when I'm contacted.
This isn't a course that's offered across universities in America, is it?
Here and there, but no, not. It's certainly not typical. I do offer one at Millersville, but that's not typical. And I'll mention that I'm not trained per se as a forensic botanist. And no one really is. The people that end up being forensic botanists are professors like myself who have a specialization in plant identification or plant taxonomy, because identification of plant matter at a crime scene is the key.
Yeah. So tell me how this works, because I'm imagining a spin-off TV series starring you, Chris. Like, I can totally see this as being a spin-off TV series. What happens? The police turn up at a murder scene, and they realize we need a forensic botanist. What happens next?
Sure. Well, if it's a case of a murder, and I can just cite a recent case that I was involved with that wrapped up in 2022, a young lady, 16 years old, was murdered. Her body was found in a dense woodland in Florida, which is in the southeastern United States. And it was a very dense woodland. And so immediately the police recognized the potential for plant evidence. When they found a suspect, they immediately went to that person's vehicle and found plant matter, leaf fragments, in the back of his vehicle. And that's when they sent that material to me.
Right. And so what can you do? I mean, obviously, you can identify this is a fern and these ferns are found in this sort of a wood. But beyond that, what else can you do?
Right. Well, in that case, you know, what you're trying to do, if you're working with the prosecution, is you're just looking to... You know, the prosecution wants to find a match between what's in the suspect's vehicle and at the crime scene. And so in the cases of leaf fragments, you're looking at small little fragments and trying to identify those to species. And in my case, with that case in Florida, there were three species that were dominant at the crime scene, actually touching the body. And those same three species were the species in the back of the suspect's vehicle. So they provided circumstantial evidence that he had been or may have been at the crime scene. So that's one way that you can do that. There are certainly other ways that you can take a more statistical approach. For instance, in aquatic crime scenes, I recently was involved with a sexual assault case and kidnapping case where the a woman was dragged into a retention pond, and the suspect got away, but they were able to develop a suspect based on some closed circuit television in the area.
Yeah.
And we went to that person's home and we confiscated his clothing and were able to find microscopic algae on his clothing that was very abundant. And I was able to match that up in a very statistical framework to the crime scene. Lots of, you know, thousands of unicellular microscopic algae that were present on his clothing was also the same algae found at the crime scene.
Oh, but I would have thought, like, because, you know, in the movies, they always say that, you know, water is, it just gets rid of all the evidence. You're, right. In this case, that actually it was because the crime happened in a body of water. It basically created almost like, you know, when you go into those into a clothing store and they have those pellets that go off with paint. The perpetrator was sort of stained with this algae from the water. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And it's all microscopic. They don't even know it's on them. So you're right. In a terrestrial crime scene in a forest, you know, you're lucky to find a few leaf fragments that the suspect picks up because, you know, they're big enough often that the suspect sees them and brushes them away. Now, there's some seeds and pollen that can be picked up that the suspect may not be aware of. But in an aquatic crime scene, every time you place your foot in the water, that foot or that shoe comes out with thousands of unicellular microscopic algae. And so actually, you know, to the contrary, aquatic crime scenes provide the greatest amount of evidence. And I have 100% certainty that if I've got an aquatic crime scene that I can and make something out of that.
Wow. Okay. And what if I were to say, well, I went swimming a dam by the lake and that's why I have algae on me. I mean,
that's right.
How yeah. precise can you, because you don't do DNA sampling on this algae, do you?
Not on the algae. That would be difficult, but certainly possible. But in that case, you know, it's pretty well established in the ecological literature, but also even in the forensic literature, that every single body of water, even similar bodies of water, have a very unique community of algae. Algae, even though they might have the same species, the relative abundances of those species can vary from one pond to the next. And it forms almost like a fingerprint-like profile of that particular pond. And so if that was an alibi for the defense, certainly we could look at that pond and we could look at that community profile on his clothing at that pond, but also at the crime scene pond, and determine whether or not that was a well-supported alibi.
Okay. What sort of, what other approaches might you take to try and get as much information from a murder scene or a crime scene when you turn up there? What sort of things can the plants around you tell you about what happened there?
Well, you know, it's not just placing a suspect at a crime scene. It's also determining timing and manner of death. You know, there's certainly cases in which there's no suspect developed right off the bat, but you find a dead body in the woods and you need to determine, you know, when that body got there, because that helps narrow the window, you know, the time frame to search for missing persons. And then once you've identified a missing person and when they got to that locality and that condition, then you can target suspects. So, you know, timing is one thing that I'd like to talk about if you've got time for that.
Yeah, we absolutely do. So how, obviously there's different timescales, right? So there might be years, but there might also be hours. Talk me through what sort of timescales you can identify with a reasonable amount of accuracy.
Sure. Well, I'll just make the call out to forensic entomology really quick, which is pretty well established that different insects colonize a body, a corpse, you know, after the body is dead. And you can use the colonization of those different insects as a pretty good timing of how long that body had been there. Now, when it comes to plants, you know, we're not necessarily working on that scale of like a week or 2 weeks. We can, you know, for example, a recent case that just happened and it hasn't resolved yet in Pennsylvania, where I live in the United States, was we found a body that was fully skeletonized in the woods. The police called me in to look at the site and we were able to find that there had been moss and roots growing around the bones. And, you know, one thing about roots in particular is just like a cross section of a tree trunk, you can count the rings and determine how old they are if it's from a woody plant like a tree.
Right.
And so I was able to take that and determine that the body, that the roots had been growing around those bones, those roots were exactly 4 to 5 years old.
Wow.
Now that provides a minimum time frame because obviously it would take a while for the soil to accumulate around that body before the roots started growing. But it does provide a minimum time that the body had been there. And then I was able to look at the roots beneath the body and determined that they were old enough that I was able to place the body there to around about the 2000 teens within a narrow range of about 5 years. Now, that helped narrow the search for missing persons.
Of course, absolutely it would. Can I ask what it's like to come across a crime scene where it's a, you know, it's a real body of someone that's died, like, you know, a skeletonized body? Like, what does that feel like? Because you must feel like you're stepping into a film in some way. Like, it's both macabre, but it also must be weirdly exhilarating.
You know, it is certainly surreal to go into a crime scene, and especially when that, you know, sometimes the bodies are just natural causes of death. A homeless person, you know, dies in the woods, and, you know, you just have to, you know, determine the age. But in certain cases, it's a crime scene. You can find bullet fragments around there. You find bullet holes in the clothing. And if there's still flesh, you can find bullet holes in the body, or perhaps some damage to the bones that were caused by a gunshot. And, you know, when you get to that crime scene, it's all cordoned off with, you know, police tape. You're surrounded by the police officers. I always find it surreal as a botanist. I'm surrounded by people with guns, and, you know, I don't carry a gun. So I certainly am on my top behavior at that point. But, you know, they're watching you work. You know, they've already processed the crime scene. They know where the bullets are. Now they want you to come in and look at the plant evidence. And everyone's waiting for you.
Yeah.
So it is quite something.
So what about fast-growing plants like mosses or mushrooms? Are they useful at all?
Oh, certainly spores of mushrooms are small enough to you know, traipse onto the shoes of a suspect. Certain mosses can be used to determine the age of the body, because they grow in regular intervals that correlate with years, just like the rings of a tree. So that is the case. However, you know, the mosses don't grow that fast. You know, when you find moss that's grown on a body, or let's say the remains of the clothing, it takes some years for that moss to start, you know, colonizing
really?
And growing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as you are, you know, picking up these pieces and sort of detailing where someone might have been, what they might have done, how long ago that was, are you also doing experimental work, trying to understand how the biology of a site changes? Because we did a piece, probably when we started out in this program, it was one of the pieces that made me think, you know what, there might be something in this science program. It was about body farms, and it was about the idea that there were research facilities scattered across the world that use corpses donated for science to see how they decompose in different environments to help police officers figure out how long something's been, how something may have died, whether or not they were, you know, scavenged by animals, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering, is there an equivalent for you? Like, or do you visit body farms to look at the fauna or the flora and see how they may have changed or adapted? I guess I'm thinking, you know, if someone has died and there's a lot of biological matter, does that enrich or damage certain types of plants like grasses and that sort of thing? Like, how do you increase your textbook, so to speak?
Sure. Well, I've never been personally to a body farm, but I'm familiar with the literature, and so I'm well read in that regard. But I will tell you that a lot of people think that a decomposing corpse could actually enrich the soil, and on the long run, that might be the case. But in the short term, you know, the fluids that come beneath a decomposing body can actually stunt the growth of vegetation for a good while, because it's pretty putrid and can have that effect on plants. And so, for example, in this case in Pennsylvania, we were able to date those roots, and there was a particular year that showed, you know, fairly narrow growth rings in those roots. And so, you know, one cause for a narrow growth ring in the wood of a root would be a year without a lot of rain, maybe a drought year. But that particular year and the years around it were actually abundantly, you know, producing rain. And so you'd expect to have large rings around that. And in fact, what I found was that they were small rings. And so, you know, that is a potential signature of the time that that body had been freshly deposited there and decomposing, because it had stunted those roots at a time when you'd expect to have rapid growth.
Right. I mean, all this stuff that you do is not necessarily grisly, right? I mean, there are presumably some cases where it's property damage or it's missing persons that end up, you know, being solved or that sort of thing? Like, or is most of the stuff that you're brought in because of the nature of your work, does it tend to be violent crime?
Most of my work has been violent crime. However, you know, forensic botany is the use of evidence from plant and algae in legal matters, and not all legal matters are criminal. And so I'll give you an example. You know, several of my cases have been with food in the food industry with quality assurance issues. When a customer has a complaint because they found foreign objects in their cookies, you know, then the maker of that cookie blames it on the provider of the spices that they used over in India.
Right.
And then the company in India says, no, 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 we have food quality assurance ourselves, and we would not never have those type of contaminants.
Right.
And so then they bring me in as a third party. And the step one is to identify what it is and then, you know, try to figure out how it got there. And so there was a recent case where the company here in the United States had blamed it on the company in Southeast Asia, thought it was a contaminant in the spice called mace that they use in their cookies. I was able to determine that it was actually grape stems, and it was traced back to the worker who had been eating grapes while on the job and had dropped the grape stems into the batter.
Okay. All right. And have you ever been in a Big Mac, a rat in my Big Mac case? I'm trying to think of what the plant equivalent of a rat in my, what about poison? Like, have you done any poison cases where you had to identify the plant responsible for creating, a poison? Was there any intentional poisonous cases you've worked on as a forensic botanist?
Myself, I have worked on a suspected poisoning case that turned out, because of my evidence, to not be conspiracy to poison. So this is a case of where there's a couple who's going through a very, you know, kind of terrible divorce. They still live together. And one comes down in the morning and finds some weird seeds mixed in with their coffee beans.
Huh.
And so they accuse the other of attempting to poison them because those seeds look like the seeds of oleander. And if you know anything about the ornamental plant called oleander, which is more tropical, it's deadly poisonous. And it's well known, and it has been used in several poisoning cases.
Huh.
So they sent the photos to me, and I said, well, I can definitely tell you it's not oleander, but I can't quite identify your seeds from the picture. So they sent me samples, and I was not able to identify the seeds at first. So I extracted DNA from them, and I was able to determine that it was a species of plant called the drumstick tree, which is a tropical plant from South Asia that actually has a lot of medicinal uses and nutraceutical uses. So in other words, it has some health benefits.
Uh-huh.
But then I, you know, did the literature search, and I determined that the compounds, the chemical compounds in this particular plant can actually interfere with certain heart medications. So I was able to testify, you know, first off, is the purported victim or the potential victim, were they on heart medication that could be negatively affected by this? So theoretically, it could have been a really slick job, conspiracy to murder, knowing that this person was heart medication, we use a plant that could interfere with that. Well, it wasn't the case. And so in the end, there was no evidence that there was a conspiracy to commit murder. But in the case of this, it actually substantiated an affair allegation, because there was a mistress involved there that did use those seeds for herbal medicine. And that just substantiated that person had been in the home and had left their seeds.
Okay. So, I mean,
okay. So,
but I mean, it's good also, but it turned it's out good not also to end with, like, actually, everything is fine. You know, it's great that some cases end in, no, my current wife who I'm trying to divorce isn't trying to kill me, or vice versa. What a really interesting way to spend your time, Chris. I'd love to spend a day in your shoes. I promise you, someone's going to knock on the door and make sure you get well paid for the TV series that's about to happen. Chris Hardy, okay. Forensic botanist and biology professor at Millersville University. Thanks for your time.
Hey, anytime. My pleasure.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
Aidan McKelvey, producer, joins me to chat. I presume there's lots of stuff they don't tell us, right? That the police don't tell us because, like, they don't want us to cotton on to it. Like, you'd be stupid to commit a crime of any significance, I think. Just absolutely stupid. In 2026, with everything we have, all the monitoring, all the shedding the DNA, the sweat, the eyeballs, the gait, everything that we can pick us up, the many, you know, various sensors around, I just feel like it's not worth the hassle.
Yeah, it's funny what your brain does when you hear a story like that. You're like, right, so I won't do that. definitely not going to go into a lake. You're thinking about like actually committing a crime, whereas when I envisage this situation, I'm always like, I'm Richard Kimball in The Fugitive. I'm like, these are the traces I won't leave because obviously I'm an innocent man and Tommy Lee Jones is tracking me down, but I'm innocent.
I see,
But you just went straight for it.
I've talked about this in the program. I often have that fantasy of just leaving everything behind and like setting, and then, you know, 40 years later, someone bumps into me and I'm like this, you know, mahogany skinned sort of surfing teacher of, you know, of some remote island teaching, you know, young kids how to surf. That's good. McCray.
Yeah, so some haggard future-proof super fan.
Yeah.
McCray.
My eyes that have gone slightly, you know, cataracty, and I looked, you know, and it's just like the it just dilates for a second and then cut to black.
Boom. Yeah, maybe let's do it as a film rather than real life.
Yeah. So we don't have any text today, but I was at a thing this week. I was at the Research Ireland's Research Communications Visions of the Future kind of conference. And one of the things that kind of came up was, you know, how close we are to, you know, to America, right? So America got highly polarized views on science. I feel like that is now irretrievable. I feel like it's a whole generation will get back, you have lost before you can get back, you know, the levels of trust that America had in research, science, experts, and so on. And the question was, you know, well, is that just America or is that the UK? Or was that? And I feel like we have, you know, the research shows we have immense trust in science. And one of the reasons I love this show, one of the reasons I think this show is important is because we talk about science's limitations, but that is that the scientific method is the best way to come to whatever we can, as close as we can to an objective truth, but also the best way to amass knowledge that is trustworthy, right? And evidence that we can say, look, this is as best as we know, this seems to be what's going on here, right? I want to ask you how close you think we are to, you know, how much it would take to tip us over into, I think one event, I think one more pandemic and Ireland could go the way of America.
No, I think we're miles off.
Do you?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of reflected in, I think we get a lot of media from obviously America and from the UK. First of all, most of your media is, you know,
so you're not on social.
I'm not that much on social, but it's biased you're towards the extreme. It's like, this is bad news, so you should pay attention to it. But in reality, the real true number is if you look at the last elections in Ireland, right? So you have the European elections, we had general elections, we had local elections. We didn't elect a single MEP that was right wing, like far right, we didn't, or far left for that matter. We didn't elect a single TD that was far right or far left. And of the 900 and something councillors, there were only four that could be classified as far right and none that could be classified as far left. So by that logic, you're talking about way less than 1% of people in Ireland want to vote for a far right person. Yet it's all over the TV and all over your social media. So it's sort of an amplification that I think is not a real representation of
people. I don't know if what we vote for is a representation of how we feel. And I know that you think it's probably the best we have. And I'd say it's reasonably good evidence. But, you know, the people who vote are typically shifted age-wise, you know, a good bit older. Like, typically. If we look at young people, they don't turn out in their numbers. And they're the ones, you know, younger people. I meet loads of great, I'm not going to start young person bashing, absolutely no interest, nor do I believe that young people are a problem. But I do worry about the competing narratives that are out there just all the time. And I do feel like we need to be careful because we have something really precious here in Ireland that we really, really value: science, research, knowledge, expertise. And I just feel like we need to do a little bit more to think. We need to think about that, because if we're wrong, if we are actually closer than we think to it, one or two things happen and people go, you know, if we had another pandemic or we had, you know, had something like that where people were in real hardship, what would happen then? I feel like what we have is so precious and valuable, because what's going on over the States is terrifying.
It's insane.
You know, you look at the leadership at the head of the country following no evidence whatsoever, with the most incredible consequences for humanity, the environment, the economy. You know,
it's a victory for stupidity.
And this is the same country that had Obama. You know, like for me, it's, you know, I mean, when Obama was at his peak, the idea of Trump being president was so ridiculous.
Yeah, but I don't think Obama was that great either. He was just a great orator.
Look, we can go, but certainly he valued research about evidence.
Yeah. I mean, he was way better.
Look, what he did, no, look, this hasn't been a great American president ever, probably, right?
John Quincy Adams was pretty good.
You know what, you're out nerding me here.
I would not.
But I guess what I mean is, from the ideals and values that Obama at least spoke outwardly and was a, you know, a leader and sort of this is what we value as a nation, to go from that to Trump in you know, 8 years is...
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Anyway, that's thoughts. Share with thoughts.
Yeah, I think the moral of the story was listen to Future Proof more.
Well, it was subtle, but now you've made it really on the nose. Of the story. You've made it on the nose. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcasts, and Hugo de Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. It's a good one, actually, because we're talking about the ethical question of whether or not we create sort of unfeeling, brainless, sort of organ-doning body bag animals rather than continue in medical research. And the idea is create some sort of unthinking, unfeeling sort of gooey bit that we just take stuff. Oh, here, I'll take a leg out of the bag. But it's living. It's kind of a crazy idea. It's on Tuesday. Look out for it. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.